You're listening to the Wheeler Centre's Fifth Estate podcast. This week, we're looking at media, police and crimes against women. How is journalism changing when it comes to reporting these crimes? And why do some crimes and some victims get more press than others? Our host is journalist and anthropologist Sally Warhaft. And for this discussion, recorded on Tuesday, September the 18th, 2018, she's joined by former Victoria Police Chief Commissioner Christine Nixon and veteran crime journalist Andrew Rule.
Christine Nixon, of course, is the former Chief Commissioner of Victoria Police from 2001 till 2009. She's now a Deputy Chancellor of Monash University, a teacher, a consultant, a mentor, and the co-author of two books, Fair Cop and Women Leading. Andrew Rule is one of Australia's most acclaimed crime journalists. He's worked for newspapers including Fairfax and the Herald Sun since the 1970s. He's worked as a radio and television producer. He's currently the associate editor of the Herald Sun and the crime correspondent for Triple M Breakfast.
Yes.
Which I didn't know. And
that was a big FM voice.
That's this is a big AM voice. He's won the Gold Walkley, the Graham Perkins Journalist of the Year Award twice, 8 Quill Awards and goodness knows what else. He is also the author of numerous books and they'll be all on sale with autographs at the end of this and thanks to Dimmocks in Camberwell. And he has a really cool podcast too called, is it Life and Crime?
Life and Crime.
Life and Crime, where he sort of just riffs on the stories of the cases that he's followed with particular investigative insight and time. And so you can get that on your device. Please give them a very big welcome. I want to start by just asking you each, and I'll start with you, Christine, about the basic relationship between police and media. And I've got a quote from your one of your books. The modern media is a voracious, unforgiving, unpredictable and unforgetting beast. And increasingly, it is also frequently not a disinterested, independent voice on the events of the day. Newspapers are players.
There it is. I think that sounds a perfectly good start.
No comment.
Oh, we'll get to you, Andrew. Yeah.
Look, it's a long, long relationship, and I think I've often felt that it was a bit of a symbiotic relationship in the sense from, you know, we needed the media in the police and the police needed and the media needed the police. And so and what I mean by it's a long relationship, I was talking to my father, you know, just recently, and he talked about sort of, he was a police officer in New South Wales, but the same existed here in Victoria where you had embedded journalists who would be in either the crime area or in the sense of in the building where the police were. So it was a very close relationship and one, I think, for the main that has been actually a really quite positive and productive relationship for both sides. So I certainly always understood that how the police got on with the media, always understood that we were never going to agree on everything, but it was a particularly important aspect for the police to understand that the media were players and, as I said, sometimes, you know, closely involved and stirring the pot and other times standing aside and throwing stones, which was part of it as well.
How would you describe it, Andrew?
Well, it is symbiotic. There's no doubt about that. Mm. By and large, police are happy, and we see this particularly in Victoria, I think police are very happy to use the media to advance their own ends, you know, in a good way often.
Yeah. And
sometimes not. Sometimes they get a bit political, some of them, amazingly. And the media generally plays that game, but it's often only, it tends to be a bit one-sided. I've noticed of recent times, I've notified the homicide squad about a breakthrough that I'd actually made by some fluke, and their response was to say, well, you can't write that story. And I said, but I have to write the story because that's what I do, and it's going around next Sunday because otherwise I might not have a job. So having given you this information that you can't get any other way, you now want me not to write it. So I then rewrote the story completely to suit them, and they still got in a huff about it and remain unhappy about it to this day, which means next time I get that breakthrough, don't tell them. And this is it's not really always the wicked media. There's a bit of wickedness on both sides.
I mean, how often does that sort of thing happen? I mean, tell us about the approach. You talk about this symbiosis. So there are clearly unwritten rules about sort of how you approach a story, Andrew, a crime, you know, that's active and current.
I think Christine and I are both at that age where we can remember two capitals, Sydney and Melbourne, when it really was symbiotic, and those old-time journos and old-time coppers really were very hand in glove. And there wasn't a lot of... That was back-scratching mostly. Now, probably there's arisen a tougher attitude on both sides.
Yeah.
And that has come up for various reasons. But perhaps the rise of the Nation Review and those sort of investigative reporters like Wendy Bacon and Brian Toohey and all those sort of people. And
Chris
in Melbourne,
Masters.
All those sort of people, Ben Hills and others down here, made it a more adversarial relationship. And it did, I think it changed in the, from the 80s onwards, 70s onwards.
I would agree. I think that early stages, I remember, again, you know, I guess going back to Sydney, but the sort of guys, Bill Jenkins, you know, they worked for the sort of daily newspapers, and they had to desperately get copy, and so it was, you know, they'd get the call and turn up and get the story or whatever. And so I think what happened, though, over time is the rise of, I suppose, the investigative journalist. And so that meant there became a bit more of a distance. So I was thinking, you know, early days, people like Wendy Bacon, Chris Masters, you know, in not just obviously print, but we're talking about all media. Jenny Brockie, particularly in New South Wales, did a major piece when she was allowed in to the New South Wales police, and she did an amazing piece of work called Cop It Sweet. And so I think that was... you know, that piece of it meant that sort of sides were taken. But I also think there's still the sense that when someone, particularly, you know, the good quality journalists and who've been around for a while, will call up and say, you know, I've got this story, you know, is it going to compromise? Now, where that comes down to, certainly, say, during the underworld, you know, murders in Victoria, there were sometimes instances where journos had got information and sometimes would say, so if we run this, what happens? And, you know, and there were negotiations went on about how long they might hold it and what they might get from having done that. So it kind of became, and I suppose what happened is policing became more professional. So I think that became an important part for us. And I think the media, you know, became more competitive. A lot of good, more journalists involved in it maybe might have change the dynamics a bit. And so these days, I think there's good relationships, but again, I think you're right to say probably a bit kind of not quite the camaraderie there might have been previously.
Camaraderie is a good word.
Yeah.
Were there times in your police career, Christine, where something was really derailed by media, by journalism?
Yes. yeah, look, there were. And I got to tell you, in some cases, that was right. You know, I'm not. In a sense, you can say they derailed an investigation, but there was also, I suppose, one of the things is you just got an external pressure from the media onto an organisation, and we needed that. When you're trying to reform an organisation, when I was younger, I mean, it was quite different by the time I'd got to Victoria Police, but when I was younger and looking at a corrupt organisation, terribly led in those days in New South Wales, it needed some external pressure and force because it's really quite hard to change just from within. And so the stories that you really wish they hadn't published but did about, you know, I mean, I think of one of Chris Masters in Queensland, for instance, which is, I think, the red light state. And then he did others on Roger Rogerson. Now, all of us knew Roger Rogerson was crook, but, you know, how anybody was going to get him. But they got him in the end. But I think having that pressure from without as well. So, yes, it derailed things. And there certainly have been investigations that you have to scramble to kind of figure out what you're going to do or execute perhaps a search warrant earlier than you'd ever want to. That sort of thing on the basis of going, well, we're going to have to get out there now because otherwise it's going to be in the media in the morning. So I think, you know, that was part of it. But mostly I think it's been a productive when it's been done properly and not maliciously by journalists.
The question that prompted me to get you two together for this discussion tonight is the one of why some cases just attract so much more attention than others. And the example I sort of go back to, you know, is the terrible killings of Jill Maher, who everybody remembers. But also within a year of her murder, another woman called Tracy Connolly, who, you know, her name is perhaps not as well remembered. She was 40 years old, strong, beautiful, independent woman murdered in her van in St Kilda. She was a sex worker and a drug addict. And we know that Jill Maher's, the crime against her, it was solved within 6 days, and Tracy Connolly's is still unsolved. And I suppose the biggest thing for me is, do we remember their names? And, you know, Jill Maher's name is imprinted, I think, you know, in every single Victorian, if not Australian, heart, but other women are just forgotten. So, Andrew,
there's not enough room in the collective, in our collective hearts, to have the same sort of grief reaction for every death. None of us do. We grieve about it, the people we know, and we all came to think we knew Jill Maher, although most of us didn't. There are other distinguishing things there, and I don't think it's the police's fault in this case at all.
That's the why fact I'm that asking to be, you
to be
first,
brutal,
yeah.
Jill Maher was Irish. Everybody loves Irish. They're lovable people, even if they're not. she's a young woman that's vivacious. She was attractive. She was friendly. She was funny. She had a drink and a laugh. She was popular. She was popular in her workplace. Her workplace just happened to be not Fred's Bread Factory in Dandenong, it was the ABC at Southbank. So when Jill Maher goes missing, John Fane cries about it on air or similar. Now, this has a huge effect on that audience, and this audience, these people here, all heard the strained voices of people on radio. Her death was no more tragic than many others, but it appeared that way because it got airtime. And you know, newspapers too. We're all there. We're all in it.
I mean, Eurydice Dixon too, of course, who didn't work for the ABC.
No, true. But she was on the comedy circuit, and yeah, she sort of fits the mould.
Christine,
I think the fundamental piece really is around: would the police have investigated both of those cases equally? My view is they would have. But I think the real issues around the good woman and the bad woman, and there's a history in that. And I'm sorry. And so there's a long history about, you know, someone who's a prostitute and gets murdered, and or someone like Jill Maher. And it's, and really reflects into this whole issue about women in crime. And I'm sorry. So the issue really is around, you know, good rape victims, bad rape victims, and what gets covered in that. And so I think there's, you know, many, many people have written about this, and so I think there's a piece of that. I think all that Andrew said is right, and I think the police would have investigated both properly same teams of people often at the police will investigate those murders, but I think there's also still that underlying difference about whether you're the right kind of victim or not, and particularly when it comes to women, I think that's a very significant issue.
So is it coincidence, do you think, Andrew, that these crimes tend to be solved?
I think it's probably... I've often said this about Jill Maher as a good example. Jill Maher was murdered in the modern era, and I mean by that the extremely modern era, when we have... Everybody's got a mobile phone that's traceable. Every car that goes up and down the freeways has a photograph taken of it. That the towers, this is the same as the Boris Dostoevsky case and many others, that in the old days, if you got away with murder, unless you left fingerprints everywhere, the only chance they had was for the police to suspect you because they didn't like you and give you a flogging until you admitted it. But to be crude, in the bad old days, and I mean by that times that I can remember, but now with DNA and mobile phones and credit card transactions and cameras on every corner and on every road, that's what solved Jill Maher. And that's what... And I'm not sure about Tracy, whether those things apply there, but maybe not as much because of the position where she was. She wasn't taken somewhere. I think there's probably procedural detective reasons why one's harder than the other. Mm. To be fair to the police, I don't think they go... soft on... No. I think homicide detectives are trying to solve homicides, really.
Yeah, no, and the same team in terms of homicide would have done that. Yeah. I mean, I think Andrew's right. All of that technology, I mean, very quickly was made available publicly. I think that was part of it. You know, I don't think that was available. It was a back street without those. And there may have been some people, but they certainly would have gone and canvassed that to see if they could find any CCTV. That's kind of standard these days. And so I think that's a part of it. I mean, it's a different issue, and I don't want to take us away from where we are, but if you think of the Bourke Street, I don't know what to call it, actually.
Carnage.
Yeah. Carnage. The massive amount of information, you know, that came through in so many different sorts of ways, I think is the way that, you know, you solve more crimes these days than you ever would have previously.
It would have to be true, though, that the prejudices and just perceptions of different kind of women clearly impact on just, I mean, how people notice other people in their everyday lives, so that when you've got a... Every article I've ever read about Tracy Connolly begins with Tracy Connolly, comma, sex worker. Every article I've ever read about Jill Maher starts with Jill Maher, beautiful, intelligent, vivacious. And somewhere along the way we'll talk about her work.
I don't think that's the police's fault, though.
This is squarely on the media.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it doesn't really have any effect on the investigation, does it? Does it?
Does it potentially have an effect on community, though, and how we notice people?
Above my pay grade, I'm not sure.
Yes. Christine? Well, in my view, it does. I mean, I think, you know, that whole issue around violence against women and, you know, what's kind of seen as... you know, acceptable, in a sense, not acceptable. What I mean by that is violence, which was, you know, the woman was, you know, walking down the street and I remember, let me give an example. I remember back some years ago a particular rape where a woman who was, in a sense, nun-like, for want of a better description, and you know, there was a kind of a massive outpouring about that. And then there was the one, you know, the questioning, what are you doing in the park in the middle of the night? What are you doing with earphones in? What are you doing dressed like that? Why did, you know, all of that. So we make, as communities, terrible judgments about women in that sense, about who's acceptable and who's not. And I guess that's one, there are examples that are, you know, have some relevance to recent cases. And so I think we, as a community, often, you know, judge women. Now the media then either follows us or we follow, you know, I think there's a bit of an equal in that, about how we would then, you know, judge those women's behaviours. But I'd like not to think. I mean, I don't think it does influence the way the police would investigate. Perhaps in the past it might have, and it certainly would have influenced how successful they thought they'd be about in trying to get a conviction, but that's a bit further down the track. But I do think we judge women way differently in terms of, you know, their behaviours, what they might do, where they might be, way differently, some women to other women.
After Eurydice Dixon's death, I think was it the Assistant Commissioner Compton? I think that was...
Andrew Stamper, maybe? No.
David Clayton, sorry. Oh, sorry. David Clayton. The Superintendent David Clayton made the remarks that was seized upon about just urging people to take care. Now, I was really surprised about that whole story, and I felt for him in that there was a murderer at large,
exactly,
and you've got the person in charge, the police in charge, saying, you know, I want people to be safe, but the public response was just fantastic too, with a great reminder, I felt, to people in power about, you know, women wanting to be able to be safe and so on. I thought it was a really key moment when the police came back and said, you know, okay, we get it. It felt like quite a significant change.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I remember, I don't think I heard him, but I think I heard him afterwards, you know, heard of it afterwards, and I could see where he was coming from, you know, and I think that was the right place of, in a sense, but to go back and say, hang on a minute, that's not right. You know, so what you're faced with in that circumstance is there was still someone, you know, at large in...
There's a tiger snake in the kindergarten.
You didn't exactly know, you know, where that person might be and what kind of risk people were at. And you're always kind of caught with saying, we wished, I think all of us, wish that women could be anywhere, any place, at any time and be safe.
That's a wish.
And that's a wish.
And that's not the real world.
And that's a sense of saying, no, this is not acceptable behaviour and women should be able to do that. And we shouldn't judge people, you know, by where they might be at a certain time. And I think that was part of it was really important. But I have to say it's hard work for the police to... kind of, I've watched them change over time, but it is hard work for them not to, in a sense, be judgmental and say, well, you know, you should all be home by 9 o'clock at night and don't even think about wearing a short skirt, you know. Like, that's what they used to say. And I think, you know, they've come a long way in all of us in policing and in terms of thinking differently about that.
Andrew, for you, for somebody who has covered every god-awful, gruesome crime pretty much that's taken place in this city for decades. I imagine your perspective on this is quite unique.
Well, grounded in reality, not
exactly.
Grounded in an understanding.
I feel for the police on this one. They're damned if they'd warn. I mean, when the girl was killed at Doncaster by the crazy guy out there, 2 years ago. There was a similar thing. There was a murderer at large, and a police officer came out and said, "Now listen, don't be walking through parks at night because there's somebody out there. We haven't got him yet," and he was held down as some sort of sexist monster, and he was only giving a legitimate warning, saying, "There's a shark in the river, do not swim." Now that is a legitimate thing. And police shouldn't be crucified for that. Crucify them for all the things that they should be crucified over, which are many and numerous, but not that. They're not beyond reproach, and I fall out with them regularly, but...
They fall out with you regularly too.
I don't think they should be criticised over those two examples, personally.
I'm sort of more interested that there was a shift, and it's a shift of language. I don't believe for a minute that there's a deep shift of thinking within police on that. Would that be a fair guess, do you think, Christine?
Oh, I think they've come a fair way, over the last while, and particularly thinking about women as victims of crimes in terms of family violence. So there's been a lot more thinking about that, and you know, I think the policing's changed, and it's still got a lot of it's old ways, I guess, but I think they've come a long distance in thinking a lot more about, and particularly in the management ranks and senior leadership, they do a lot of thinking about what they're going to say and what they're not and what implications of that. So I think they have moved.
Mm. And they're a younger generation. No, they're different people from the people of our generation. Mm. Not you, Sally.
Well, she's still young.
She's still young. But they are the generation of that are my children. Yeah, they're different from the people I grew up with. Mm. They have a different set of attitudes and roll their eyes at people like us. Oh, me.
How have things changed, Andrew, in the time you've been a journalist with covering domestic violence from a media point of view?
Well, I would have thought once it was... I mean, everybody talked about domestics.
That word is difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And yet I think it's become... I think it's a great swing towards the correct attitude is these are very ugly things and people are very badly hurt. I mean, most of the homicides in the old days were...
Still are.
Domestics, which is why there was a high clean-up rate. Mm. Why did you... True story. I was having lunch once with a homicide detective and he said, oh, yeah, we drove up 5 hours to Cabbage Street Creek up in a mill town. And I said, righto, Joe, why'd you kill your wife? He said, the bitch burnt the fish. Mm. And he said that was sort of, that's what we did. We go up there and get some idiot who's knocked his wife over and kicked her to death because long-standing animosity, etc. But over something like that, burning the dinner or whatever it was. And he said that was really... They did a lot of those jobs. And, of course, that murder will have been the climax of a lot of ugly incidents.
35
locally
years worth of abuse.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Drunken Friday nights, the whole thing.
I think it has been interesting to watch the way the police... It's taken a long time for the police to work through this issue about family violence and to recognise it and to stop saying it's someone else's role, it's someone else's responsibility. And obviously I had a fair bit to do with that while I was within Victoria Police and in making us focus on it. And I think the other piece that I watched, over time was then support from the media to start to talk about it. I still think we've got a long conversation yet to start to recognise the enormous harm in our community that's done by family violence. And, you just watch... I happened to be in Brisbane and, I was watching the thing in Perth where the murders... it's just such a fundamental part of our communities that's so bad and so sad. And I think we need to just get, more of it. So perhaps if we're confronted with it more, then more of us will start to see, this massive harm that's been under the surface. So no one wrote about it, no one much talked about it, and we need to just see the harm, short-term, long-term harm that's done in our communities by family violence. And in terms of thinking through, today, I was, you just think of a number of examples. I was thinking about the Rosie Batty situation with her son being murdered, and I was trying to think through why it got such a lot of publicity at that stage. And there was a couple of things about it which made a difference, I think. One is that Rosie is articulate and actually as a victim, obviously she was as much... her son was killed and she's also a victim, but she was actually able to say something about it. And I think... And then because it was also public, that meant that it was in a public place. And so I think those two things, and the third we thought about the other day was the other thing she did is, of course, accused the police of being the ones that allowed it to happen. And so that meant the police then kind of started to look more and more about whether or not, they were responsible. And that, so all of that together, I think, meant that she was given a lot more recognition and therefore, in many ways, was able to help drive a lot more recognition of family violence within the state. That she wouldn't have ever been given that kind of standing before, and in some cases, victims, they wouldn't have been able to take that capacity either.
What sort of changes have you seen within the police? I mean, changing police culture is tough and long.
Yeah.
So how does that happen with something like family violence?
I think what we tried to do was to have the police recognise the harm, recognise that they had a responsibility to make a difference in this space, and that using, you know, the various sort of law, particularly intervention orders, particularly arrests, and then even moving the offender out of the house, you know, all of those sorts of things were able to make a difference. And so I think it was both. I remember a woman came to me when I announced that Victoria Police was going to actually do a whole review on family violence, and this woman came to me and said, "Christine, I want to be part of that." And she was an older woman, and I said, "What do you think you could do?" And she said, "Well, could I be involved in educating the police about what this was really like to live for 35 years as a victim of abuse?" And I said, "Okay, that's great." And so not only did she come and be part of an internal video we produced and talked about, she kind of pulled the myths up, you know, the myths that she said, you know, people said to her, "You must have liked getting hidings, or why did you stay?" And, you know, the other myths about, "Oh, he's such a nice bloke." And she said, "Yes, I used to think he was too, but he would bash us every second day." She had three boys as well. And so the sense of what she was able to do was very persuasive for a lot of police officers, because she named it. And here was a woman who looked like their grandmother, you know, and able to say what a horrendous life she had. And, of course, she also went ahead and had him charged. She would never have done that. And so he went to jail. But so I think, you know, the police officers, first of all, understanding the enormous implication, perhaps a change in generations was a part of it as well, and then recognising the sort of long-term effects it has on our community. I mean, you look at all of you in this room, you know, we know the evidence says that one in five of you, you know, will have been involved in some way in a family violence incident in your life. And it's your, you know, victim of it, you may have been an offender, you know, a child or people who saw the situation. So I think the other piece we try to convince, you know, talk to the police about, and I think it worked, because what happens is, you know, we're now in a trajectory of reporting, which is an important piece. And now, and of course, a Royal Commission, a significant amount of funds being involved, and people now recognising this harm. And so I think it's about convincing the police that was the important thing we should work on, and how much police work goes into family violence related is just massive.
And warranted, mostly, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In, you know, your editorial meetings, Andrew, or, you know, in the newsroom, are these things that are discussed periodically, or is it a more responsive?
It's more responsive. I mean, I think we've like starlings in flight. We've all moved in a certain direction. Basically, I think it's a more decent world in many ways, for all its faults, than the generation that I knew as a youngster in the 70s. I think people are now nicer to each other in many ways. I think males are nicer to females now than they were in my generation. And I think that's a move in the right direction that is reflected in the police force, in the media, and every aspect of life. It's just changed. It's like we don't smoke in restaurants. We don't. There's all things we don't do now that used to be accepted, and that's one of them.
Do you
think,
agree?
Hang on.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I think there's some great lessons we could learn from some of the major social changes. So the smoking piece in restaurants is one bit of it. Not drinking and driving in motor vehicles, I think we've changed it. If we can only learn the lessons from that and apply it to family violence, because I don't think we've changed in that sense. I still think. I wish, you know, I started off in the police in 72 and went to my first domestic violence incident. You know, women didn't do operational stuff, but I did, you know, get involved in the 74 or something, and I'm only a kid, like I'm 21. And I think, I have to say, in those days I wished, can we do better than this? Can we do something about this? And we've still got such a long way to go. You know, I only wish it was as easy as stopping people smoking, or because it's a fundamental inequity in our society about the way women are treated. And it just flows to everything. I mean, I wrote a book with my friend Amanda Sinclair about women leading. And, you know, you just have to start by looking at the lack of progress. I mean, recently all the discussions about women in the Liberal Party, well, they're about to go backwards in terms of women in that party, but women in senior management positions. I mean, I'm still the only woman in Australia to have been a police commissioner. Now, we've had women in policing since 1915. And so I think we've changed in some ways, but around equity and recognition of the talent and skills of women, and the harm done to women in family violence particularly, I think, you know, we've still got a massive way to go.
Sometimes it's just blatant hypocrisy too. I settled down on, I think it was Friday night, to see who Richmond might be playing this week in the preliminary final. I was all relaxed. I was really looking forward to it. And on the screen, Channel 7 is Wayne Carey. And I just looked at it, I thought, how is this possible? How is this possible? This is somebody who pleaded guilty to indecent assault, somebody who was arrested for smashing a glass in his wife's face. She later withdrew the charges, and he then assaulted the female police officer that had come to do that arrest. Now, this is obviously prior to recent changes, social movement changes with Me Too and so on. I'm thinking, well, the AFL sacked two blokes for having consensual affairs within the past 12 months, but they allow Channel 7 to have this man who, to many women, I would imagine is just a trigger of horror. I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like for women who've experienced violence if he had such an effect on me and I haven't. How is that possible? How do things like that get overlooked?
It's a complex area, this, because the scenario that Christine so well described of domestic violence being entrenched has produced a Wayne Carey. Now, Wayne Carey came from Wagga Wagga. His father was a petty criminal and very bad lad who was violent. He would encourage his boys who were, you know, athletic and tough and strong to fight for the benefit of his mates when they were little boys. And this has happened with other criminals that I can nominate. Mm. One of the Russell
Many
Street bombers.
Many.
Who's now dead. The main Russell Street bomber was treated like this by his father. And he would throw them in a room and get them to fight each other bare knuckle while his drunken mates threw money at them or whatever. And that has produced Wayne and his brother Dick, who was arrested on drug charges. He's a very large, strong and probably violent man. And so these things are self-perpetuating and they perpetuate. So if you wanted to, you could run a case that Wayne Carey is a recovering victim who's been through, done bad things and been through bad things and is now on the way up and on a higher plane. Or you could say he's just a beast and should be buried and never see the light of day. These are both valid.
You could
points.
Say that he's some sort of reconstituted human being who's remorseful for his past sins, but that doesn't mean that you know, he gets a prized gig in such a public forum from an endorsed by an institution, the AFL, that says it cares about women.
That's a good question.
How do you reconcile those two things?
How do I reconcile? I can't.
I'm asking.
I look like Gillon McLachlan.
Yeah.
I think there's a whole lot of issues that you'd have great difficulty reconciling what the AFL does, and maybe I should stop at that point.
No, we've got a few more minutes.
I just look at what they you know, the Women's League, you know, women have been playing AFL for years, and gee, finally the boys recognised. I mean, you look at the construction of the commission, you look at all of that, and You still have to say they are reflective of our current situation in our community, and I guess one of the reflections is someone that you've spoken about is able to appear and make, I assume, significant amounts of money without any kind of consequences.
Hmm. We'll move on from that one for now. And I want to ask, I'll start with you, Andrew, about the effects of these long-form podcasts. So it started with Serial in the US, and then, of course, we've had them here, Trace, and the most recent, Hedley Thomas's The Teacher's Pet. Now, the thing they all have in common is when you put that intelligent, time-laden, digging deep, investigative lens, it seems on almost any case, things are discovered, things that have been missed.
Very interesting.
Isn't it just?
They are. And, I mean, I read a beautiful piece at the weekend, which is not about a crime. It was about the ins and outs of a small feud in a bowls club in Queensland. And it was quite riveting because it was beautifully written. It just shows you can get the microscope out and do almost anything if you do it well enough. There are no bad stories, only bad writers.
That's true. But when it comes to, you know, a crime, so when that lens is put on, you realise that without it, an injustice or a lack of information, perhaps for families, or is just they're just never going to get that information without a good journalist.
Tricky place, New South Wales, in the bad old days, silly. Back before Christine's day.
I remember.
I don't think it was just the AFL. It might have been the rugby people up there in bed with the local coppers, and everybody knows everybody, and we're all friends, and things, you know, just some things just don't get chased much. The bits of paper went under the blotter or whatever. I'm not suggesting a massive corruption or collusion, but some things just seem to hit dead ends in the old days. And is that right, Krista?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Just didn't get past go.
And particularly...
blank looks.
Particularly that one. I mean, that took place actually on the Northern Beaches, which is where I grew up, and so...
So it's your fault?
No. No, I didn't work there. But you can see all of that coming together, in this case, the football, rugby league.
League, not
union. People played together and, you know, there was a lot of that went on. So... So they pick a particular case which is long unsolved and then, you know, particular because it was a woman, the twin brothers. I think there's a lot that Hedley might have picked out in that one that looked like it might be one that you want to, you know, write about. Some quite unusual facets of that particular story. But, you know, it is a very interesting new form of journalism. I lament the lack of the long form, you know, good investigative journalism that really should be around. I mean, I regret that you're not allowed to really do that much. I regret that some of the...
No comment.
You don't have to. I'm telling the story. You know, I think that's what we really should push back on. And this is a technique. I mean, he's obviously given a lot of time to go do it. And so
I think a year. I think full time.
So, you know, if that's the case, the Australian wants to spend its money that way, then I think, you know, I'd hope that others could do the same thing because it's a very important piece. And whether it's a cold case or whether it's you know, a new matter that they spend a lot of time digging in, you know, I have a lot of respect for the investigative journalism and the way that it pushes us as communities. And, you know, whether it was any of the people, you know, we've spoken about before, Chris Masters or Nick McKenzie these days or others, but we need that kind of journalism and I think we greatly miss it as a community when you don't have people who feel free to do that. I mean, you know, this, you know, with the living in the democracy and freedom, you know, we talk about that, you know, people, freedom's right to insult each other, you know, is a little bit of it. People's right to write this kind of material that allows us all to be so much better informed, you know, in long investigative pieces, I really think, you know, we need to advocate to get back.
Well, that's about resources, isn't it?
It is.
Within I'd like police to see you on the board of a few organisations, Krista.
Thank you.
I mean, if you'd given a cold case detective, say, a year and said, you know, you can work on something for 12 months and you're going to have all the resources that you need and you need to come back with what? I mean, Angie, I'll throw this one to you. What do you think would come, would be presented compared to what a good investigative journalist would find?
How long's a piece of string? Look, good. There are very good detectives, and given the right resources, I'm sure they'd do good work. Remember, they have one advantage. They've got a warrant. They've got a for search warrants. They've got ID. They can get into systems that we can't. Mm. They can in America much more. But if we want to find someone, we can't look up the Leap database.
Nope.
We can't even bribe a copper these days to look up the Leap database because they've closed that off.
It used wasn't to be, that hard work.
20, well, in the good old, bad old days. And, you know, journalists really work with one hand tied behind their back compared with the police. Having said that, it's similar work and...
It's just going the long way around, isn't it? I mean, are there really that many people you've not found in your career, Andrew, that you're seriously looking for?
Yes, there's lots that we don't find. But it really is, look, this sort of journalism is about finding people. It really is about tracking down a door to knock on and saying, hello, I'm here to help you, or, you know, and getting their story. And that's, I mean, both cases, detectives and journalists, that bit of it is similar. And we write the story and they write up a brief. But it's essentially sort of twins. Twins like Danny DeVito and Schwarzenegger, but twins. Mm.
I think one of the issues about cold case is, of course, the advantages in DNA. I mean, I think we've got a lot of those matters where they're now, you know, dragging up matters. You'll all of a sudden see someone charged with a 25-year-old murder. And that's, you know, on the basis of DNA and using that kind of evidence to... Now, you don't convict someone on on DNA. You get a significant, you know, foot in the door with it. And I think sometimes people think, oh, well, you know, they'll just be convicted because of it. That isn't the case. You've always got to find other sort of evidence to substantiate your view that this is the person. And so... but when you've got old records and then you add it to new DNA... So in that sense, I think you know, if you set someone down for a year and said to them, you know, can you figure this murder out that happened 25 years ago, you know, with all the resources we've got, if you wanted to put that money into it and that energy into it, you'd go pretty close towards it, and they have.
Mm. Is there someone whose full-time job it is just to run DNA?
Oh, yeah.
In the police, yep. As that's just all they the do, they're just running it through.
I mean, one of the things, you know, people aren't all that delighted about is the bigger the database, the better off we're going to be in finding people and finding, you know, that solutions to crimes that have happened, you know, now and happened in the past. And so I think, you know, that's one of the things, and looking for swabs and looking for samples in various sorts of ways is an important part of an investigative tool that the police really need.
Mm. On that topic, I was tipped off some years ago about a potential killer for Easy Street, which is the notorious case of two women killed in a house in Easy Street back in the 70s. And it comes up every so often.
Every time the house is sold.
Every time the house is sold, for a start. The media brings it up, which is very sad for real estate agents and the owners. And I was told by a prisoner, an ex-prisoner, that someone he'd served time with was as mad as a cut snake, and he said he was locked up a week after Easy Street and was out of circulation for many years on another murder, and he's the one. Everybody in jail says he's the one. And it actually made sense. And I tipped off a wise old homicide sergeant, Christine, who you would know, who's no longer a homicide sergeant. And he said, leave it with me. And I think what they might have done, and I'll deny saying this, I think what they might have done is sit off that fellow's place and set up a 0.05 point and get him to breathe in the little tube and then keep it, and went down and DNA'd it just to see if it happened to match with the body fluid that was found at the scene of the murders, which was apparently a negative. But this does make you wonder also about whether the body fluid at the murders was the murderer, which is a whole other story.
Of course, yeah.
Which we won't go into here.
I'm going to throw to your questions in a moment, but while you're thinking of them and putting up your hands, I just want to ask each of you, Christine, if there's a crime, you know, a piece of crime journalism work that really stands out to you, that you really admire as somebody, you know, who's worked in
choose
the police
me,
for
miss.
So long?
Choose me, miss.
You can talk about your own. I don't know if there's a particular one. I mean, I think there's been a lot of them, and I suppose my particular view is not quite the crime in the way you're talking, but I think really about exposing, just significant pieces. A woman, a journalist in New South Wales called Wendy Bacon, who I think went to extraordinary personal risk to expose corruption and so I think her work, I mean, I have to have been probably the only person in the New South Wales Police who actually thought that, but and didn't she get a hard time? But if it hadn't have been for someone like that, that then kind of, you know, just opened the door, it's not the kind of crime you're talking about, but it certainly made a difference to how we went about investigating crime otherwise. And I think that courageousness of journalism, was a very important piece. And there are more people now in policing who recognise that and know the value of a courageous journalist.
With police doing good works, I think Mick Miller, not the late Mick Miller at all. He's still very old. He's still with us.
He's older.
He was a great man in many ways, and I think he was really a bit of a watershed appointment after all those those olden days, wicked old former World War IIers who did their time. We both remember the end of those, and Mick Miller probably ushered in a more professional Victoria Police Force, and that was good. But specifically, I think there's been some detectives, and we need not name them, that have worked very hard beyond the call of duty to solve crimes to help those who are related to the victims or the victims themselves.
Yes.
Now, one that comes to mind is the Michelle Buckingham case up at Shepparton, and there are many. After 30 years, they solved that, and the family got some sort of justice, and that was just dogged police work with a little bit of journalism thrown in. But the detectives who have worked and are now former detectives are still working on Mr. Krul. I know ex-coppers who still keep an eye on that and still pass on information if they hear it, because they want to see a result for the victims and their families. And this will go unheralded, but one day they might get the breakthrough.
If you've got a question, you can just put your hand up and... Oh, great.
In connection with the good woman, bad woman comment that you made, Christine, but the question is to both of you, how much do you think class does or doesn't interact with that?
Some, but I still think it's a pretty overwhelming view about women generally. I think there's a small amount of it, but I don't think it's enough that you'd sort of see there's a difference in a wealthy woman versus a poor woman. And so I think it covers, it still carries. I don't think there's much difference.
Yes, it is interesting. Influence and wealth can make some difference perhaps to the reaction, because some people can make more noise, they have more connections, they can get, questions asked in Parliament, probably, some of them. So we all bring pressure to bear in our own way if it's something to do with ourselves, and that's only natural that would happen. So perhaps there is a difference between the street urchin coming to grief and the extremely wealthy and powerful person, because the relatives of the powerful one can make more noise. Mm. And the squeaky wheel does get the grease. Look at the Hedley Thomas thing. If the teacher's pet, if there weren't 18 million hits, if it wasn't such a massive thing, would they be digging up the yard around the house? I don't think so. Mm.
No, I think he's made, in that sense, he's forced the police to do something they should have done 25
properly
years ago.
Mm.
Mm. Notwithstanding the much-heralded decline of investigative journalism, I think John Sylvester wrote in the other paper last weekend or the weekend before that Fairfax have currently got the best investigative journalism team they've ever had. But outside of journalism, do you think there needs to be an independent body outside of the police that actually investigates the police? Because I think currently that's something the police do and people have criticised that.
Yeah, they have, and they've been criticising that forever. And I think I've seen a variety of models over time. I argued that we had a model in New South Wales, a model in Victoria, where there was an oversight body that was aware and knew report, you know, the allegations to them. And I have to say, for all of the kind of ways people have sort of denigrated some of those oversight bodies, I think they've done a fine job. I've certainly been held accountable by them, and so has both police organisations I work for. The real issue about handing over to outsiders is, trust me, they aren't nearly as good as the insiders are. And I've always fought this, I still do and still would. I think that the police should be made accountable and responsible to investigate with an oversight that then is able to check and come in and to make comments or take the investigation off you, which is certainly what they did to us in Victoria Police on occasions, and I didn't have a problem with that because they had more powers and more capacities in some cases. But I think that the police... I certainly watched a lot of the work that policing did, and I think it's quite reasonable that they should still be held accountable to investigate their own and have oversight.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk tonight. I've enjoyed it. Well, sort of enjoyed it. But I just wanted to bring something to your attention. 4 years ago, a very kind young man smacked my head against a wall in domestic violence thing. The police came and the policeman said, I'm not used to dealing with domestic violence. I deal with real crime. And then he said, however, to remove a man from his home is a big thing. Have you got somewhere you can go? And that was from a 35-year-old cop.
Yep.
So I'm just wondering, what do we do as women in that kind of situation? Where do we go next?
I think you lodge a complaint against him. You see, that's entirely inappropriate. You know, there's legislation that allows and encourages and, you know, men to be taken out of those circumstances, and there's a lot of facilitation that, you know, is that's what it's made to do, rather than take women or women and their children out of homes. So I think that's a neglect. It's an inappropriate response. It certainly isn't sanctioned in any way by the management or the legislation of policing. The bit about your line that I think said, you know, that's not real police work, or, you know, that kind of thing. You know, I used to really get annoyed with the police about that. I kind of said, well, what do you think your job is then? And, you know, there are lots of things police say, oh, look, they're not my job. But, you know, this is their job, has always been their job. And they are, you know, doing better than they ever did. But you still have, you know, people like that in that circumstance where that person did not do the job in the way they should have.
Were you willing to press charges?
Complain.
Yeah, two or three more policemen arrived.
Cool.
They negotiated with the man for 2 hours and eventually he left.
Right.
And they did take him to court. And when I got to court, the police were very, very good.
Okay.
And he was excluded from the home. However, at that moment, when you need someone, it's all very well, yes, I'll lodge a complaint later,
yeah,
but at that time, what do we do as women when we meet that? What can we do?
1 minute left.
At that particular time. I guess that's the problem, really. You could actually call the local police station, ask to speak to the senior police officer on duty and say, this is not acceptable response. You could do that. At the time, though, it's actually very hard work if you find someone like that. I'm glad some other people turned up shortly afterwards and did the right thing.
Is this a kind of... Was this a daily problem in your time?
Oh, yeah. Mm. I mean, it, you know, previously, to get much done, you know, was always like, it's not my job. And, of course, they'd say, well, what would happen afterwards is the woman will go to court and she'll withdraw the complaint. That did happen and still does. But we just said, so what? You just do what you're supposed to do and do the right job and do what the procedure and processes say, and that's your job.
Mm. One more quick one.
I heard on Radio National today that it costs like $100,000 to lock someone up for a year. And in Bourke, in New South Wales, there's been a program to sort of help Aborigines, you know, get off the street. And like for that $100,000, you could give them like five jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all that frustration of unemployment and petty crime could be absolved. Can you comment, please? Oh,
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think if we were able to put into place much better interventions, much better ways of dealing. I mean, one of the things I think Victoria did really well, you know, was bring the elders into Koori courts and in a sense in the Aboriginal community. And I did hear about a magistrate in Walgett recently who's, you know, very pragmatic in the way she was also going about her work, putting people into jail and you know, that $100,000, I agree with you, we could do much better in many cases. In some, you know, people, they deserve to be there and it's the right thing to do, but in many other cases, you know, a job, a meal, all of those things would make an enormous difference, and I think we need to do much more in that space.
Please thank Andrew Rule and Christine Nixon, and thank you all.
Sally Warhaft, Christine Nixon and Andrew Rule, live in Melbourne for the Fifth Estate. Coming up next on the podcast, Sally speaks with journalist and author Greg Sheridan about his views on the changing shape of Christianity today. Find out more at wheelercentre.com. Until then, thanks for listening and take care.